in the days of the judges. And so this book takes place during this time period. So we're not so much studying the book of Judges, but we're studying the days of the judges, and that would certainly include the book of Ruth. All right, let's look at just a few introductory comments. We'll be looking at chapter 1 today. That'll be our focus. And we sort of said some of this Wednesday night for those who may not have been here. This will be somewhat of a repetition for those who were. When we go through the book of Judges and we see just those same stories over and over again, apostasy, it's sin and rebellion, whatever word you'd like to use. As disappointing as that book is, this book is just as refreshing. This is such a wonderful little book to study. Again, verse 1 says it's the setting is in the days of the judges. Can't say for certain which judge it is. The Bible does not say. I think it would have to be somewhat early in the time period to account for Boaz's age. And who was Boaz's mother? Well, chapter 4, we have his father. Doesn't tell us who his mother is. But we know it in Matthew chapter 1. She's in the lineage of Christ. It's Rahab. And so, for Rahab to have been rescued in the days of Joshua, she lived in what city? She was a harlot in Jericho. And how young of a man is Boaz in this book? Well, we have information that he's somewhat older. He's not a young man. We don't know how old he was, but he's somewhat of an older man compared to Ruth. She's a young Moabitess, and Boaz is somewhat older. But for Salmon, he married Rahab, and they had Boaz. And then you have Boaz had Obed. Obed had Jesse. And then Jesse, of course, was the father of David, the king of Israel. So many suggest that this had to take place not long after Joshua's death. In Brother Waldron's book, and again, most of you have that, he entertains the thought that possibly this story took place perhaps right before or maybe even during the judgeship of Othniel, the first judge, which would be very early on, again, not long after Joshua's death. I think we can say, and again, I can't say for certain, but to me, this is a pretty good argument. It most likely would not have occurred during the judgeship of Ehud, who was the second judge after Othniel. And the reason why would be Elimelech would not have taken his family to Moab, and they're the ones that are oppressing Israel during the days of Ehud. That just doesn't seem to have been a choice that I would have made as a father. Oh, well, there's famine here in Israel. Let's go to Moab. And they're the ones that's currently really putting it heavy on Israel. And again, Brother Walter makes that point in his book as well. Okay. 2 points that I want to make, and it's these two, both about Boaz and Ruth. I think this short book emphasizes, in the first place, with all this rampant idolatry and faithlessness in Israel, as a whole, one could describe the nation of Israel that way. But even if everybody else around you is not doing good, what can still be done? You can still serve God. You can still be faithful. And what kind of man is Boaz? How would you describe him? He was a good man. Faithful, loved the Lord, he treated his employees well, he was thoughtful of others. So even in Israel, all this is going on, he can still, you know, we can still do good. And there's some lessons in there for us. We're surrounded by so much ungodliness, but we can still do good. But what's the emphasis about Ruth? She wasn't a Hebrew. But what impresses us about Ruth? By the time you get to the end of the book, what do you think about Ruth? Absolutely. Now, she wasn't raised in the covenant of Jehovah. She was a pagan. So how does she come to have this kind of character? I mean, she's been taught. She's been converted to Jehovah. Well, maybe so. She married Mahlon. Now, We know which one married which one. We don't know it in the first chapter, but in chapter 4 of Ruth, when Boaz is redeeming Ruth, he says, I'm taking to myself Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon. So Orpah married Chilion and Ruth married Mahlon. Perhaps he taught her. Maybe Naomi instructed her. Whoever it was that taught her, she seemed to have been very willing to learn, and she became convinced in Jehovah. She wanted to be a part of His people. And so we see the good heart, willingness to be taught about God and then to actually live for Him. And there's a lesson for us as well. Emphasis always on the heart, being taught what's right and good. All right. So those are some of the overreaching or overarching lessons that we'll talk about when we go through the book here. Let's get to chapter 1 now. These are the questions on pages 44 and 45. Let's first look at the first 13 verses or so, and we'll talk about the sojourn in Moab. The book begins the fact that there was a famine in the land. That's in the first part of verse 1. It came about in the days when the judges governed or judges ruled, that there was a famine in the land. Drop down to the second part of question 2. We'll go ahead and answer this. Do we have any indication why there might have been a famine? I mean, you read of famines a lot in the Scripture. That happened a lot during the days of the Bible. Could there be a reason why there was a famine at this time? Okay. If you turn to Deuteronomy chapter 28 and those verses listed there, some of the punishments that God said He would bring for Israel's faithlessness. If you're unfaithful to Me and you don't obey My commandments and keep My statutes and judgments, particularly I think it's verse 24 of that chapter, God said that He would make the sky as bronze and the ground as iron. And that's to put what kind of image in your mind? Yes, dry, just arid, just no moisture at all. And so the book does not say that's why God sent the famine. But again, what's the theme of the days of the judges? Faithlessness, idolatry, the very things God said He would punish. This very well could be the reason why the famine was here. And I can't prove that it's so, but that certainly fits in with this previous passage from Deuteronomy chapter 28. Okay, so what people are described to us? We get to the last part of verse 1 and into verse 2. Who's the character or the cast of characters here? Who are we told about? All right, we have a man named Elimelech. What tribe is he from? I'm sorry? All right, he's from Judah. Bethlehem of Judah. Bethlehem, Ephrath. He was an Ephrathite. And there's more than one Bethlehem, obviously, in the Bible. So Bethlehem Ephrathah, or an Ephrathite, would be to designate the Bethlehem that's in Judah. That's his name. His wife's name is Naomi. All right. And they had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. That's the family of four. And they're Ephrathites, or they're from Bethlehem. And we just simply see here at the end of verse 1 that a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in Moab, and in verse 2 tells us who they are, and they traveled to the land of Moab for relief from the famine. And that's how the story begins. Well, the next thing the story tells us is what? Well, not all at once. At first, who dies? Elimelech dies. So now Naomi is a widow. And this seems to be the order. Verse 3, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. Well, then what do? Well, they marry. And they take for themselves Moabite women. Orpah, that's not Oprah. Sometimes people say Oprah. No, it's Orpah. And Ruth. And again, Chilion marries Orpah, and Mahlon marries Ruth. How long were they married, these two boys? About 10 years, and then after 10 years happens, then there's more death. And this time it's the two sons. So within a span of 10 years, Naomi loses all the men in her life, and she's left with her two daughters-in-law. That's it. That's what she's got. This is through verse 5. Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. All right. Well, the next thing that Naomi hears, it's a different angle to the story. What's she hear now? All right, she's going to decide to go back to Judah. Well, why? Oh, yeah, verse 6. She had heard that the Lord had visited His people in giving them food. The famine is over. Well, if our earlier conjecture is correct about the reason for the famine, then the famine being over, what might that indicate? They had repented, and isn't that one of the factors in the story of the judges? There's oppression, and Israel would cry for deliverance, they would repent, and then God would send the judge or He would bless them. So if the famine was because they were unfaithful, now that the famine's gone, that could be that they had repented and stopped their present idolatry. Again, can't say for certain that's the reason, but that would fit into the story. So the Bible describes this as God had visited His people. He was thoughtful of them, He was mindful of their needs, and He brought them food. So she arises to go back to Judah, her two daughters-in-law with her, verse 7, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. So they're going to leave their own homeland and go back with Naomi, because now she's family. I mean, she's their mother-in-law, and they're prepared to go back with her. And what does Naomi do starting in verse 8 through the next couple of verses? Yeah, she tries to persuade them or convince them, basically, you need to stay here. You all are from here. And she gives them reasons that we're going to look at just in a moment. These are the reasons that she uses to persuade them. It's really no use for you to go back with me. Now, what were her reasons that she gave to convince them to stay where they were? All right. What'd she say first about herself? Right. Well, not only that, she couldn't bear any more children, but she also would not be doing what? I am too old to marry again. Doesn't she say that? Yes. I am too old to have a husband. So she has no plans to remarry. Now, of course, marriage first. Then after marriage, then she uses what reason? Well, yes, I'm not going to have any more children. If I'm not going to marry, I'm not going to have any more children. And then she says, and even if I did marry, and even if I did conceive and have sons, what's the next thing she says? You going to wait that long for those boys to grow up to marry you then? Because the custom in Israel, and not just in Israel, but in most of the surrounding regions, what was the custom when there was a death in the family? Yeah, relative or a brother. And of course, this is going to be the predominant factor in this story, what we'll call the near kinsman. Someone would take the widow to himself and marry her. Usually it was the brother or the nearer kinsman, whoever the nearest kinsman was, and raise up children in whose name? The first husband that was dead. And so she's saying, I'm not going to marry. I'm not going to bear children. And then she just assumed, and even if I did marry, and even if I did bear children, and they were sons, I mean, they could have been daughters. What if she didn't have any more sons? But even if I did have sons, you're not going to wait long enough for them to grow up, and then they would marry you. So see, she's saying, she's trying to reason as logically as she can. There's no good reason for you to return to me. So she says, go back to your father's house. And then she says something else too. Go back to what? Your gods. Go back to your way of living. And I pray that the Lord will be as kind to you as you have been to me. They've been very thoughtful of this woman. Yeah, and to the dead. Yeah, she mentions the dead. Verse 8. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. Thinking of their husbands and their father-in-law, Elimelech, who was, of course, now dead as well. So these are the reasons that we just talked about. She hoped the Lord would be kind to them. She wished they would each find happiness and that they would marry again. They're young. Obviously, they can remarry. Now, initially, both said no. All right? verse 10. No, but we will surely return with you to your people. And upon them saying no in the first place, that's when she goes through all these reasons we just cited to convince them, no, you need to go or you need to stay here. I'm too old to remarry. I'm not going to bear kids again. And even if I did, you wouldn't wait for those boys to grow up to become of a marriageable age that then they could be married to you. Well, how successful was she? Was she successful in her reasoning? All right. Well, what do we see about Orpah first? What's she doing? Orpah. Well, I'm looking at verse 14. They lifted up their voices and wept again. So this is an emotional moment. And then it says, Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. And it doesn't say it's a goodbye kiss, but I think we're left to conclude that. And how was Ruth described? Orpah kissed her, but Ruth's hanging on to her. My version says Ruth clung to her. She's not going to let go. So Orpah has decided, you've convinced me. I'll stay here in Moab. But Ruth's mindset is what? I'm going with you. There's nothing you can say to me that's going to convince me that I need to stay here. And this is where we get some of the most beautiful words in the book of Ruth, spoken by Ruth herself here. So all three women are weeping openly. Orpah kissed Naomi, and Orpah decides to stay in Moab. We know that's so because look what Naomi says, verse 15. What does Naomi say to Ruth? That's right. She says, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. She's going. So I want you to stay with her. I want you to go with her. And don't stay with me. I can't offer you anything. You don't know any of my people. I mean, she could make all these reasons. And there's just no reason for you to go with me. So do like your sister-in-law. Now, what did Ruth say? Listen to these beautiful words. Verses 16 and 17. Norm, read Ruth chapter 1 for us, verses 16 and 17. Now, if you just take Ruth's statement at face value, what she said, what opinion do you get of Ruth? All right. She says, may the Lord do so to me and worse, if anything but death. Yes. Right. Yes. The fact that she says, may the Lord do so to me and worse, she has put herself under an oath, hasn't she? Somewhat of a divine curse. I'm going to keep my word. And if I don't, may the Lord do even worse to me than if I don't say or do what I'm saying right now. So she adjures herself, let's put it that way. She's under an oath. But what else impresses you about Ruth here? Just looking at her statement. All right, she has some understanding of Jehovah, doesn't she? I don't know how deep it is, but she knows something. And we would say that, why? Because her word said, your God's going to be my God. I am willing to live in this religion. I'm willing to serve Jehovah. Now, as someone pointed out, we don't know who it was that taught her. Maybe Mahlon did. Maybe Naomi did. Whoever it was, she has learned something about the Lord. And what else has she learned about in what she says? Not only will your God be my God, but who else is going to be hers? Your people. Your brethren. don't know how many Hebrews she knew. I don't think she knew any of them except these. But she's willing to make those people her people. So, would you get the idea that Ruth, let's try to find some descriptive words. Is she determined? She's committed. She's not going to be halfway about this. She is all in this for everything. And the only thing that's going to part them is what? One. It's death. Now, how many have heard these words spoken at a wedding ceremony? It's become quite a familiar, at least when the couple's reciting vows and sometimes the bride will say something and they'll borrow these words from Ruth. Just sort of make the point that I'm committing myself to you today. And Ruth, of course, this isn't a marriage ceremony, but they just borrow Ruth's words. So Ruth is not going to be persuaded. Naomi, there's nothing else Naomi can say to change Ruth's mind. Again, here's these important words. Do not urge me to leave you, for where you go, I go. Where you stay, I stay. Your people will be my people, and your God shall be my God. Here's a Moabitess. What would have happened? Let's do just a little bit of conjecture. What would have happened in the book of Judges if the Israelites had said stuff like this? That's right. A lot of the things that we kept reading over and over again in all those stories, they wouldn't have had half the trouble they had if they had had this kind of commitment. And here's a Moabitess. She's not even in covenant with Jehovah. And she shows at this time, she shows more faith than the average Hebrew showed in all those stories in the Judges. What's that tell you? Just about Ruth as a person or anybody. If you want to bad enough, what can you do? You can set your mind and you can do the Lord's will. You can do it. Any of us can. It's well within any of us to do things that would be of a commendable nature like this. Yeah, that's a good point, Freddie. Freddie's point is, look what Ruth is willing to leave. She's willing to leave all she'd ever known. Her family, her religion, her friends, her lifestyle, and go to a place, go to a land that she didn't know anybody over there. She's going back with the only person she knows, and that's Naomi. Yes, Charles. Yes, that's a good point to make. Naomi's words, go back to your gods, would certainly indicate some degree that when Ruth got associated with this family, became a part of it, that she began then to practice the religion of Jehovah. How easy would it have been for this family in Moab to practice the religion of Jehovah? Well, it would have been somewhat difficult, I think, not being in the land of Israel. But I think that's a good point to make, Charles. Who's this? Naomi. Well, she has some pretty harsh things to say here in this chapter about God, and we'll discuss that in a moment. But here's this. I want us to be impressed with Ruth's resolve. And to me, it's even more telling because she's not a Hebrew. Even though she married a Hebrew and she learned that religion, she's still a Moabitess. And she's had to learn this. And I'm impressed with her commitment. Being a stranger, being an alien, not a native Hebrew. So anyone can learn the will of God, anyone can, and can leave their prior life and practice what the Lord wants them to do. Any of us can do that. That's a good example for us to think about and to follow. Okay, so obviously Ruth had learned something about Naomi's people and her God, and so she's not staying with Naomi just because of some emotional attachment. No, you're my mother-in-law, I loved your son, and I just want to be with you. Well, I'm sure that was part of it, but that wasn't the main part of it. She's committed to God now, it seems to me. That's the main part of it. And she's willing to live out her conversion to Jehovah. So Orpah went back, and Naomi was not going to do that. So again, here's this point that the seriousness of Ruth's words are seen, and that she placed herself under an oath. Again, that's at the end of verse 17. What did Naomi realize? After Ruth says all this, what does Naomi realize? Verse 18, she might as well be quiet. Verse 18, when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. Okay. I won't press the matter anymore. For somebody to say nothing but death's going to separate us, I mean, that's pretty strong words. And Naomi saw the seriousness of Ruth's resolve, if you will. All right. We skipped over a couple of verses that will at least verse 13. And I'll pick this back up. We're at the top of page 45. Now, this is question 7. This verse, and we'll jump ahead and cover verses 20 and 21 as well. I know we're not covering them in order, but these all go together in theme, if you will. Let's look at some of the things that Naomi said. All right, verse 13, and then verses 20 and 21. Now, in verse 13, this is when Naomi is speaking to her two daughters-in-law, trying to convince them to stay, or to not go back with her to Judah. Doug, read for us verse 13. Okay, this is an important part of this story. It's an element where we have to make some application ourselves sometimes. First thing that Naomi says, verse 13, how does she describe her present situation? All right, she says, it's a hard time for me. It is harder for me than for you. So she saw her life is hard right now. And then she said what? The last part of verse 13. The hand of the Lord is against me. That's what she said. That's how she felt. God's against me right now. All right? Drop down to verse 20. Now again, this is when they're back in Judah, and she is talking to the women of the city when they see Naomi and Ruth come back into town. And here's some more statements. Doug, now read for us. Let's see. The last part of verse 19, they come to the city. It says, the city was stirred because of the two of them coming into the town. And the women said, is this Naomi? Now, Doug, verse 20. All right. She says, don't call me Naomi. The Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. Her present situation. Verse 21. All right. So the Lord has. I went out full. I had my family, and we had all this going for us, and then all of a sudden, it's just all gone. So went out full. The Lord brought me back empty. And the Lord has witnessed against me. The Almighty has afflicted me. Now that's what Naomi said. And I'm asking you in question 7. Do you think there was any truth in this, or was this just Naomi's grief talking? Was any truth? Has the Lord afflicted Naomi? Has He been against her? Has He been bitter towards her? Well, and then let me rephrase my question. Has the Lord been, as she describes Him in her statements, personally toward her that way? I don't think so either, Freddie. All right, this is providence. But how does Naomi feel? But see, to her, what was reality? That's how she saw it. So in her mind, yes, I've been afflicted. His hand is heavy on me. It's just been awful. Okay. Okay. Now, for those who didn't hear Brother Lambert, she's putting all this together in her mind. They left Judah because of the famine. And again, if the famine was because they'd been unfaithful, which is what Deuteronomy 28 talked about, well, that was she had to live through all that, get over there, and her all the men in her life die. So she's feeling all this. And I guess what I'm asking here is, do we still see this kind of activity happening today with people? Yes, we do. We hear people say things. How about biblically? Does anybody else in the Bible sound this way? I thought of Job. We can look at several rather strong statements that Job said that he shouldn't. In fact, at the end of the book, he retracts them. He says, I said things I shouldn't have said, and he retracted those and repented. So the point I'm making here is, I don't think there's truth to Naomi's words in that God was picking on her and he's afflicted her. He's been bitter towards her. His hand was heavy against her. I don't think that's so. In life, what do you have? You have ups and downs. All of us do. Naomi wasn't the first person to ever lose a husband. I'm not making light of death. I'm just saying that happens. If you live long enough, what's going to happen to those you love in your family? They're going to die. You may outlive all of them. You may do it. You may be the first one to go, and they're going to grieve your death. However it goes. But one of the tragic things we see in human behavior is what? They're going to blame somebody, and that even includes blaming, most of all, blaming God. Yes, Doug. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Oh, you mean their two sons? Okay. All right. 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 And we see that, I don't want to use the word prevalent, but we see this a lot among people. Bad things start happening, and okay, I'm going to blame God. Why did God cause this to happen? Why did God cause that to happen? And God doesn't cause bad things to happen. God will allow things to happen through His providence, and some will be good, and some will be rather tough at times. But we need faith to get through those bad. So many times people will speak rather harshly, and I think Naomi's just lashing out in her grief here. I'm not making light of her heart. I'm sure her heart was quite heavy. But I cannot agree with her that the Lord was acting against her bitterly. Yes, Roger. Well, the question that Roger asked is, did the sons sin by marrying Moabite women? Well, the only answer I can think of, if it was wrong for Mahlon to marry her, then why would the Lord bring Boaz and Ruth together later in the book? Now, she is converted. Also, in Deuteronomy 7, you don't see Moab listed in the list of nations that they were told not to marry. Moab's not listed there. So some would say, it seems to me that they died because they married these foreign women. Well, that's an argument that you can't make from silence. We don't know why they died. They just died. That's all we know. But those are sometimes those are some of the answers that you'll see. That's a fair question. That's a good question. But I can't say that's why they die, because they sin in marrying these two women. That doesn't seem to fit the rest of the flow of the book. Okay, quickly now, let's get to the end of this chapter. They come back to Bethlehem. They come into the city. And they're gone 10+ years. It says the Bible says the city was stirred when they saw Naomi. And they ask the question, is this Naomi? Of course, Ruth is with her. And she refused her name. Her name means pleasant. But she says, no, call me Mara, which means bitter. She's still clinging to this mindset. There's nothing much good about my life right now, so don't even call me Naomi. nothing pleasant about my life. It's very bitter. And she was consumed in her grief. And I asked the question here, this is question 10. What was it that Naomi in her grief could not see? What's going to eventually happen? Well, okay, I wasn't thinking that long term. You're right, Brother Lambert. David would eventually come. But notice in chapter 4, we'll skip ahead just for the moment. Look at verses 16 and 17. At the birth of Ruth and Boaz's son, what did they do? Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap, and she became his nurse. And the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." So they named him Obed, Ruth and Boaz's son. Wonder how full her heart was when she held that baby. Yes. See, the point I'm making is when we sometimes feel consumed by grief, and we even go as far as to try to find someone to blame, and even someone lashes out and criticizes and blames God, we just can't see. Life is so bad right now. What good could ever come from all this? What good came from it? There will be future blessings. There will be. If not in this life. And she had some in her life. But real quickly, look at 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And I asked that last part of question 10. I believe Paul makes a good point here. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Let's see if what Paul says isn't on point here. Verse 16, "Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For a momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. Things which are seen are temporal." What if we have temporal adversity? But what if we have great adversity in our life right now? How are we supposed to see it? Temporary. Short term. And it is short term when compared to what? Eternity. And so if adversity is ours right now, and all of us go through that, some of us go through it more than others. I understand that. But the thing not to do is what Naomi did. But the thing to do is keep doing what? Keep trusting in God, and He'll bless you. Somehow blessings will come, even if you don't see them in this life. If you're faithful, what's Paul say? You'll have glory far beyond all this adversity that you have in life. And won't it be worth it? That's the point that needs to be stressed, I think, using this as an example of that very thing. So they arrive in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. That's how the story of Ruth in chapter 1 concludes. They're at the end of verse 22. So, somewhere on our calendar, it's around March or April, if we just, for curious sake, that's about the time of year that we see that happening. So, that's how this story gets underway. So now they're back in Bethlehem. But not long after they get back there, what's God going to start to do? He's going to get this plan going. And who's going to be the central character? Ruth doesn't even know about him. Naomi will eventually learn, well, he's in our family. He's a kinsman of my husband. And we're going to have the interaction of Ruth and Boaz together. So, Lord willing, on Wednesday night, we'll try to cover most, if not all, of Lesson 20. I know it's two chapters, but again, the chapters are short reads. I think we can get all that covered in class Wednesday night. Thank you for your good comments and your participation.